Welcome to the Resolving Violence Podcast, created to deliver current Canadian prairie-based research on violence and abuse to service providers, people with lived experience, and the general public. I'm Jordan. And if you'd like to learn more about factors that influence violence and the ways you can address them, let's get started.
Kira Stockdale is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology and Health Studies at the University of Saskatchewan. She is also a registered doctoral psychologist who has provided professional psychology services in the province of Saskatchewan for the past 15 years. Kira has expertise in clinical, correctional, forensic, and police psychology, having worked within local criminal justice and mental health systems, and was the first full-time operational psychologist working within a criminal investigations division of a municipal police agency in Canada. Kira's clinical research and scholarly activities have primarily focused on assessment, treatment, consultation, and advocacy for justice-involved youth and adults with histories of violence. She is passionate about applied forensic behavioral sciences, clinically informed community safety technologies, and innovative interdisciplinary collaborations that can prevent violence and promote safer communities for all. In today's episode, we will be discussing research she did alongside computer scientists titled The Application of Machine Learning to a General Risk Need Assessment Instrument in the Prediction of Criminal Recidivism. We hope you enjoy today's episode. Hi, Kira, and welcome to the podcast. I'm really looking forward to chatting with you today. So today we're going to be talking about your paper you were on machine learning and risk assessment. And so to start, I want to keep in mind that, you know, we have an audience that's not only researchers and clinical psychologists, but people from different fields and the general population as well. So I'm wondering if to start us off, you could just explain like what risk assessment is, who is doing it and when, and why it is important.
Well, that is a great question. Thanks for having me. And you know, we all assess risk in our daily lives. Like, what is the risk? It's going to rain or snow. So normally we're evaluating the risk of something that's unpleasant or harmful to us. So we all do this naturally, but in a criminal justice context, we're looking to assess risk of things like reoffending or future involvement in the criminal justice system or future violence. And so what we've come to know over the last 100 years or so is that if we just do a gut feel, like, yes, no, it's going to rain versus, oh, high risk or low risk for future offending, we're often wrong. And so we need to develop some structured tools to help us assess that risk, because the criminal justice system makes a lot of decisions around risk. So we want to make sure we are assessing the risk for those negative outcomes in empirically validated ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's obviously a lot of risk assessments that people can use. And I know that in this project specifically, you were looking at the level of service case management inventory. And I was wondering if you could give a bit of a background on that measure specifically.
Sure. It's a good segue, Arianna, because there's lots of tools out there. And sometimes people don't know that police officers administer some risk assessment tools, probation officers do, psychologists like me do. So this one is a tool that's often administered by probation officers, parole officers, or psychologists within the criminal justice system for people who are already involved in the system. And what it looks to do is to assess your risk of reoffending, not just focusing on your static factors like your age and, you know, those demographics, but certain need areas you may have that are related to your future involvement in the system. So antisocial peers, substance use. And so we would call it a dynamic measure, which is important because people can change, right? And so using a tool like this supports repeated assessments and evaluation of change over time.
Right. And so you're talking about static and dynamic risk factors. And I'm wondering if you could explain that a little more just for some listeners who might not know kind of why those are important in risk assessment and the differences between them.
Yeah, sure. You know, there's a lot of controversy too right now, because if you're using tools that are only static, so your age, your ethnicity, how many offenses have you had in the past, a lot of that stays the same or maybe gets worse if you accumulate, right, a larger criminal history. And we know that past behavior is predictive. So some of those things we want to consider. But if you're making decisions based on things that people can't change, it increases your risks of using that information inappropriately. Or if I attend a correctional treatment program, I emerge on the other side of that, the same risk. So if your tool includes some dynamic factors like you know, do I have an attitude that's pro-criminal, or, you know, am I going to be involved in a gang? Those things can be quite dynamic and change, you know, acutely or over the longer term. And so we need to take those into account. So why we decided to select this tool is that it is dynamic, but it not only assesses your risk, it has a case management component. So you're supposed to develop a plan to address these needs as well. All risk assessment should be risk prevention, right? That's the main business. It's not to just say, oh, you're high risk, you're a danger to everyone. It's to identify factors that can reduce risk for that individual and keep them in the community safe, ideally.
Yeah, absolutely. Super important having these measures. And so looking at the kind of other side of this paper, which is about machine learning, and recognizing that, you know, I'm not a expert in machine learning, and you're obviously in psych as well. So with your understanding of machine learning, can you explain, like, kind of generally how it works, and what was the reasoning behind using it in this project and the applicability to risk assessment?
That is a great question. And yes, I am no expert in machine learning either, although I wish I was. But it does point out why it's important to partner with others in terms of other disciplines or professions to solve complex problems. And so we know data is increasing. It's the time of big data, and we're getting more of it. So you need different measures and different techniques to be able to analyze big data. So what we tried to do is partner with faculty in computer science to learn if we could test some of their fancy machine learning techniques to see if we could improve the predictive accuracy of the tool, its ability to identify certain need areas linked to criminal recidivism. And the reason why we were doing this, actually, to be honest, was if these techniques had some value, we wanted to use them in a project we were working on to assess risk of kids reported missing to police and their likelihood of going missing again. So this was a test study to evaluate these new methodologies. And I'm sure my friends in computer science would have a much better answer than I would. But if you think of artificial intelligence as techniques that are trying to mimic human cognition, you know, machine learning is a subset of those where it doesn't try to be a human. It tries to identify patterns, oftentimes in big data, to be able to develop statistical models to predict certain outcomes, such as reoffending or how likely a youth is to be reported missing to police again.
Right. And would you say that, like, efficiency maybe is kind of part of what's driving this use of machine learning and AI? Just because it obviously is, like, missing children is a very substantial thing that we obviously want to be working towards preventing those kinds of things from happening. So,
yeah, I think, you know, there was a newspaper article, I think once here, for instance, in Saskatoon, where I'm based, that said, you know, children and youth reported missing, mostly youth from care homes, was the third most frequent call for service that police received. So you're exactly right that when you have a huge volume, you do need ways to identify risk and help locate, you know, children and youth quickly, because it's not just about finding them. They're exposed to potential harms, right, in that time that they're gone missing. And with, you know, the criminal justice data, when you think about all the data that's out there for assessments, repeated assessments, there's thousands of administrations of the LSI CMI each year, and data's not getting any smaller. You do want to develop procedures to be able to increase your efficiency and cost effectiveness. But that's not only the biggest factor, I would think. One of the biggest factors is that these techniques could identify some latent patterns and trends that other techniques may not, you know, yield. So it's possible that if we're adding up the items on our risk assessment tool, getting a score and using that to kind of assess or evaluate risk for reoffending, we are potentially missing some of the patterns that are embedded in, you know, those scores. There's, if I am a person who's assessed using this tool and I get a score of 22, there could be any number of people out there with the same score and different combinations of items, right? And so these techniques could also add a different level of information to our understanding of risk that we didn't have before.
Yeah, and I think that's a good segue to my next question is, has there been previous studies on machine learning in risk assessment? And if so, what kind of things did they find?
Yeah, when my colleagues first started working on this and we were kind of poking around in the literature, we did find some previous research. A lot of that was on some static measures or static variables. So there wasn't any that we could find based on a fourth generation tool like the LSI CMI that had dynamic needs and, you know, includes those risk need areas that can change. And so, you know, we chose it for that reason. And one of the authors on our paper had access to a data set with something like 100,000 wow. administrations, not for research, but in real time. Mm-hmm. So also some real world data, and it's hard to get large data sets to be able to test some of these techniques. So that was good to have.
Yeah, absolutely. So now that we have some solid background information, I want to turn our focus to your study specifically. So what was the specific purpose of this study, like your research questions and things like that?
Mm-hmm. So I think our main purpose was to see if machine learning approaches could have added value. Could these approaches enhance what we already know? Could enhance our understanding of the predictive accuracy of these tools? And if they were applicable to these types of risk needs data, could then we take that and apply that to the work we were doing on missing persons and missing children and youth specifically?
Yeah, and how did you go about assessing this? I know you mentioned that there was over 100,000 administrations, so I'm sure that had a big part of it.
You know, that was in a data set that had previously been collected. And so, you know, there was access to that data set, which was great. And so then it was selection of the different types of machine learning techniques and comparing those, because often we think of machine learning or AI as one thing, right? But they're a collection of technologies or statistical techniques. And so, you know, selecting those and testing those out was, I think, you know, the bulk of the work that our partners in computer science did. But then looking at those results and saying, okay, are they meaningful? And how could they be meaningful in a criminal justice context was really interesting.
Yeah, so with that, what did you guys find in this project?
Well, we found that, you know, the machine learning approaches did comparably to, you know, what we would have been using in the past, where we, you know, sum up each kind of score that we have for an item on the tool. You kind of get a presence or absence, you score it up, and then that links to an outcome, in this case, risk for reoffending or risk for future violence. Mm-hmm. And the techniques we used were comparable in terms of their ability to predict, you know, future reoffending. But we also found, which I think is interesting, is that these techniques, the machine learning techniques, could add additional predictive accuracy to the middle values of the tool. Yeah. So to my example talked about previously, these middle medium risk scores of 22, they could actually determine, or were determining, some patterns there, that if you had certain patterns of scores to get a 22, that may make you higher risk than somebody else who had a different pattern of scores, but also a 22. So I'm oversimplifying there, but what you need to know is most of the people who are assessed are not in the very high risk to reoffend range or the very low. Yeah. They're in the moderate group. So if we have a better understanding of what's happening with those folks, it's not just about improving the accuracy. It's about knowing the patterns and helping them intervene in those patterns linked to crime. Maybe this type of approach could be valuable in future.
Yeah, I know when I was reading the paper that those middle scores, that finding really got me, because, you know, I'm recently been a little bit exposed to risk assessment. So it's all like really new knowledge to me. But yeah, when you're looking at somebody who has really high risk, like it's kind of clear what you're going to take from that. And similarly with people who are low risk, but what do you do with those people in the middle that could go either way? I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah. And then think about it from a prevention standpoint, because what if those combinations of scores to yield a 22, what if there's different pathways to those? And so mm-hmm. what if those pathways involve children and youth running from care or being involved in the criminal justice system? It may help us understand early intervention in a different way. Or if these techniques are valuable, could we add different sorts of data, like data from people who are involved in the justice system or social media data, other sorts of data to maybe enrich our models, not just to predict reoffending, but to be able to intervene in these pathways towards the criminal justice system.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I like what I know about machine learning is that it's obviously it learns over time. Like the more information you give it, the more it's going to learn and be able to predict things better. So it's just really interesting to think about like where it could go in the future. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on the implications of that and kind of what you see the future of this being.
Yeah, well, you know, my friends in computer science tell me that there's multiple types of machine learning or AI. You know, sometimes there's things that are supervised where, you know, you have a test data set, which we did, where we divided the data to kind of identify the statistical patterns and then use that to predict on another portion of the data set or the sample. And so we're monitoring that, we're controlling that. It's not as though there's an AI or there's a machine that's going off and making these unsupervised mm-hmm. decisions. So I think we need to be careful about how we're using this. But I think, you know, if we're using it every day when our Netflix is telling us what we want to watch or our phone is sending us alerts, why would we not use these types of technologies in ethical and responsible ways to try and help keep people safe and prevent people from, you know, entering the justice system or staying trapped in the justice system? So mm-hmm. I think sometimes we think there should be moratoriums or we should have regulations, and maybe that's the case for some things. But I think more of this work is required as we get more data. We need to manage it, to your point about efficiency, but there's things that we don't know that we could do better at understanding, and maybe some of this technology can help us.
Yeah, that's such a good point about how kind of machine learning and algorithms are so entrenched in our daily life now. And I'm sure we could go on a huge tangent about the ethics of that and what that means for practice in psychology and other disciplines. But I won't take us too far off track. So that's all super interesting. And I think like this is really incredible and important work. And I think like in the future, we're going to be seeing more of this as time goes on, and I hope it's done in ethical ways, of course. And so for our last question, this is something we ask all of our guests, and you can pull your answer from just your general experience or from this paper as well if you'd like. But if you were to give a service provider one practice to work toward in the long term and one simple thing that they could begin implementing today to support justice involved populations, what would it be?
Oh, that's a super challenging thought. I have so many answers. I mean, one of the things I'd like to tell people is to not be afraid of technology and to partner with others and hear their thoughts. As part of the project we're doing on missing persons, we incorporated persons with lived experience. So youth who have been missing in the past or may have had criminal justice involvement, and their perspective really helped us in our work. And so, you know, if we don't reach out to our computer science partners or we don't hear from people with lived mm-hmm. experience, we're not developing our technologies with all of those vantage points. And a valid criticism of this work is that we only looked at one particular tool, right? And so even though there's a lot of data, there's only one data, which may be biased even in what it's being collecting, because we're looking for that. We know that's important, but we don't know how that compares to other information. So, you know, to be able to canvas information sources broadly is important. And then my last most practical point, I think, would be to think about, in addition to talking to colleagues with different opinions, with different disciplines, and integrating that understanding in your work, is to try and think about early prevention. A lot of the work about risk assessment is prevention, and oftentimes it just gets thought of as we're going to label you and put you in a box, and that would be, you know, an inappropriate use. We do want to intervene early, and this is why I'm so excited about the application of this technology to younger groups. And so if we can involve, you know, interdisciplinary partnerships in this research, or have people who are involved in those groups partnering and thinking about how we can use risk assessment to prevent future harm, future violence, that would be something that I think would be obviously a worthwhile enterprise to do.
Yeah, absolutely. You're speaking to some of my like very core values and probably a lot of people listening as well. I know like in my cohort, we've talked so much about interdisciplinary practice and kind of what that's going to look like in the future and how necessary it is and kind of how unfortunate it is that it hasn't happened sooner. And absolutely, like, completely agree with the prevention piece as well. Obviously, we will support those who are struggling, but it would be really awesome if we could get to them beforehand, before things get too hard.
I agree. That's how I got here. You know, I was doing a lot of work with adults in the criminal justice system, and those adults were like, Kira, you need to go work with younger people to prevent them getting to this adult facility. And I said, I don't think you guys would have listened to me when you were younger. And they were like, we might have, you have to go try. And then I went to work with youth and I saw the problem at a developmental level. And now I think, how can we develop community safety technologies to help these youth, to help people in the justice system, but to keep everybody safe, because those in the criminal justice system are often victimized too. So how can we incorporate different voices, perspectives, and technology to do this is something that I'm certainly not an expert in, but I'm a partner in, and I think that's my take-home message too.
Yeah, absolutely. And what you said about youth maybe not wanting to listen to older people, authority figures, things like that. I think that is where a lot of people get stuck. I know that thought has crossed my mind. But yeah, I think it's just a matter of gaining that exposure and learning all the strategies.
And understanding, you know, you're exactly right, Arianna, because when we were partnering with a person with lived experience who had been running from care and maybe had some criminal justice involvement, they were reminding us, you're not just running from something. Like, you're not just violating a rule and running from your care home. Mm-hmm. You're often running to something. Maybe you feel unsafe there and you're running back to your house or you're running to your grandma. So people don't know where you are. And so that's a concern. But that these are very complex problems. So whether it's missing children or people's involvement in the justice system, we need to think at an interdisciplinary level and partner with others to have solutions that make sense, not just for individuals, but communities. Because if there were easy answers, the guys in the correctional who told me to go work with kids would have found it, or people in the system would have found it. These are huge problems to solve. And some of this technology may be really helpful to doing so.
Yeah. One last follow-up question before we close off. You know, you talk about interdisciplinary practice and reaching out to people in other fields. And I'm curious if you have any tips for people about how to kind of establish those relationships and maybe where it would be best to start.
Well, I think what's best to start, and I had, you know, lots of people and mentors that I look up to helping me to think this way and gather groups together. But some of the people I've been very fortunate to work with, you know, in government, policing, corrections, in the youth system, it starts with a common problem or focus. And if you get people focusing on, you know, what we could tackle together, then I think you have already a platform to do some great work. And the hardest part is actually learning each other's language. So anything you can do to help translate the concepts you're talking about to each other, it makes the work go faster. Because I've certainly been part of teams where it took us a couple months to realize how I was defining, I don't know, recidivism was way different from what they were thinking. Or they were thinking the LSI was a test that someone took and it's pass or fail. And I'm saying, no, the probation officer is administering it. So it's, you get so mired into what you're doing that I think to actually define terms and make sure you're hearing and understanding each other is really, really key. And once you've done that, then, you know, so many different ideas get exchanged and some cross-pollination, fertilization of some really good solutions happens. And I think that's where you can have some really innovative work.
Yeah, that is such a good point. I've definitely experienced that where I'm working with somebody in another field and just the words that we use to talk about things are completely different. So that's a really good tip and something to remember. Well, thank you again for joining me today and talking about this project. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Resolving Violence. If you're interested in learning more about today's guests and their research or Resolve Saskatchewan, please check the show notes below. And if what you listened to today was helpful, please consider sharing it with colleagues and on social media so we can work collectively to resolve violence. Thanks again. Until next time.